Ladies and gentlemen, as well as kids of all ages, welcome to Season 1, Episode 3 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming! In this episode, we look at small press RPG companies. We ponder, is there a game balance? We then look at finding role-playing game adventures and everything you see. And lastly, we have the super secret double probation topic of landing your first writing gig in the role-playing game industry. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 3 of RPG Circus. My name is Jeff, and I will be one of your ringmasters here at RPG Circus. Joining me, as usual, is Mark and Zach. And we are also excited to be joined by our guest ringmaster, Phil Mayer, also known to some as Chatty DM. So welcome, Phil, and I hope you will enjoy being on the show.
I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. Anytime, Phil.
Yeah, thanks, Phil.
Yay.
So, why don't we just... go ahead.
We got some news today, don't we?
I got news. I don't know if people want to hear it, but let's get started with the news. Ladies and gentlemen, before we go into the main act, may I draw your attention to the sideshow where we will discuss some industry news. First up, Gen Con's creditors now have to wait in line. It's official. Their bankruptcy proceedings have been approved by the judge, so if you are a creditor of Gen Con's, you're going to have to wait in line now, which is good because now Gen Con can focus on actually running a good show in August. They only have, at the time of this recording, 28 days.
Oh, man, it is close. It is coming in real soon. So, good news for Gen Con, though. Very good news. I'm glad kind of get that behind him and move on. So,
yeah.
Good news, folks. If you are at Gen Con, you may spot me with a mic that has RPG Circus or the Bone Scroll on it. So if you do, you can come up and talk to me. I'd be more than happy to record your interview. So let's get to the other news, which I think was kind of shocking to me that a lot of more people didn't talk about it. Wizards of the Coast have seemed to found a solution to their PDF piracy, and it's missing. Seems the latest PDFs available for DDI members... have all fluff, no crunch. They've decided, seemingly, to omit the rules for the powers. They give you the description, and that's about it. They require you to actually look it up in the character builder or on the online rule cyclopedia. And from what some people say, it's like, well, what happens if you cancel your subscription? You have this PDF that describes somewhat the base class, but you can't really use it in play.
Or what if you want to look at it when you're not anywhere where you have access to the internet?
Yeah, you know, like it used to be maybe, you know, a couple years ago. So, yeah, it's another kind of another head scratcher in the Wizards of the Coast piracy crusade.
I still think they just need to come out with all of their books on the Kindle. I think that would help a lot.
Hey, I'm cool with that.
It would limit it to the people who own Kindle, but at the same time, there's no way for you to, copy that type of stuff currently, I don't think.
Well, I mean, it's better than what they have now, which is nothing. So, I mean, hey, you know, pick a platform and let's go with that. I mean, there'll still be the gnashing of the teeth, but that's just about routine at this point. So,
they're not one PR disaster short. I mean, there's plenty of them going around. But the thing is that most of the clientele is still art-bound book based. So most of the D&D players, I'm willing to bet that maybe 70% of D&D players are still concerned about books and art books, art cover books and dice and whatnot. So, and the people are already online. I mean, it's a boneheaded move, no contest, but I mostly use the character builder and D&D compendium, so I don't much care about the PDFs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just, I just found it interesting that, you know.
Sure.
I mean, I found this post and, like, nobody, I mean, I'll have a link to it in the show notes to the blog that talked about it. I think it's by Decree of the Czar is the blog.
Mm-hmm. Very good blog.
Yeah.
And, you know, but the interesting thing is, like, nobody else commented on it. I'm like, well, that's really interesting. And, like, did they just kind of slide this one under the table and no one care?
Or maybe no one notable or no one, you know, not notable, but no one with a big voice enough noticed it or was inconvenienced by it yet.
Yeah. Could be. Exactly. Like Phil says, I think sometimes we overestimate the amount of people impacted by these online decisions. Yeah, I mean, it's enough to make people upset, like with the previous pulling of the PDFs and everything. Yeah. I think, I don't know, maybe people were just still worn out from the last time. I don't know. To me,
it's annoying, but it's annoying to me sort of in the academic sense, because I never bought the PDFs, and I'm a hardcore or a hardback player. Like I buy the actual
hardcore
physical.
Hardback.
Yeah. I just buy the physical copies. I have no reason to get the PDFs because I don't play online or anything like that. So it's more annoying to me in the purely academic sense.
Sure.
Well, I only buy the PDFs because I like to cheat at work.
Yeah.
You know, it's much easier to look at a PDF while you're at work than to pull out the hardcover for a book. What is that? Never mind, it's a programming manual. Trust me. You know, that doesn't go far, you know.
All of our computers are faced out towards the main part of the room, so I can't get away with that.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm lucky I share a cubicle with myself. So
nice.
All right, why don't we go ahead and continue on? Cool. Seems the Starship Warden will fly again. Signalfire Studios has announced they will make a D&D 4th edition version of Metamorphosis Alpha using the GSL. Seems James Ward, who wrote the original, and I think almost every edition since then, is very excited about having this new version. Kind of makes me wonder, if this is successful, whether we might see another Gamma World version, this time for the GSL.
There was one for the OGL, I know. Of Gamma World, at least.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There was a poorly received version a couple years back. But, yeah, I'd say they're probably about due for another one. Seems like every few years,
I was once thinking that Traveler had the most editions possible, but I almost want to say Gamworld almost has that. It's like I think there's been at least 6 editions.
Mm-hmm. Traveler's a weird mix of editions and different systems for it. You know, because now it's supported for the Heroes system, and you still have Traveler 20 out there, and now you've got Mongoose Traveler, which is pretty close to Classic Traveler.
And GURPS Traveler. Yeah.
There's the New Era. Yeah, there's a lot of Traveler.
Let's not forget that, you know, from Far Future Enterprises, there is the Traveler 5 DVD with PDFs with rules that I can't say are complete.
No.
And someone's reply to me when I said that was, oh, you need to read the forums. It's like, why should I be reading the forums for rules that should be in the PDF?
But I'm sorry, I've never played Traveler, but what you just said about all those editions kind of reminds me of another fantasy role-playing game.
Which one's that?
You don't want the one with lots of editions and you know, people warring about it? Sorry.
Oh, no, 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 no. You don't have to be sorry. That's actually very true. I mean, you know, D&D's at edition 4. But actually, if you count, like, the old Red Book basic book, that's another edition in a way. And then
Collectible D&D.
You have people out there who claim there's been 8 or 9, you know, unique or distinct editions of D&D, and I can't say that they're wrong or right. It just kind of depends how you look at it.
Exactly. So, finally, let's get to the big one. The Ennie Award nominations have been released, and it looks like some guys we know are on the list. Critical Hits and Mad Brew Laboratories, both from the Roleplayer Games blogging network, are represented. So congratulations to both those sites. I personally have no idea which one I'm going to vote for. I just hope that one of them wins.
I'll probably just flip a coin.
Well, I just...
Go ahead. I have no personal preference, but I do host one of those blogs.
So, yeah, no, I just think it'd be great for the network. So that's my that's my hope. I hope one of them actually does win. However, there is still controversy over a few of the nominees, especially in the free RPG category. Seems several bloggers have dislike for the entries in this category, entries that they deem are basically just advertisements for pay products. Matter of fact, a couple of them have actually started campaigns to just vote for one or two of the actual, what they claim are actually free products. And coming to some shock to us in the podcasting community, podcasts that we would have expected on the list are missing. And this is probably mostly due to the fact that they didn't submit themselves, and, well, it seems like maybe they just don't care. The podcast listed, I don't recognize, and if you do recognize them, I guess I've been living in the Big Top a little too long.
There was a couple that I recognized, but...
All Games Considered, yeah.
Yeah, All Games Considered, and I listened to Return to Northmore,
too. Yeah,
but
I
listened to that just sort of occasionally.
Yeah, I think...
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, Phil. Go ahead.
Is
You're
it
the
Return
guest.
To Northmore? Sorry. The Return to Northmore, that's the actual play podcast, or am I mistaking it?
Yes, that's it. They do actual play, and they sort of also have in there, they explain the module. Like every other episode, they'll do explaining their module, and then they'll do the actual play, so you just see how it plays out, and then they have all the information in PDFs for how you can run the module yourself.
Yeah, wow. I was told it was very good.
It's a very interesting format.
Yeah, there's a lot of effort put into it.
I think one thing to remember with the online products and the electronic products is one of the, I guess, gripes or whatever you want to say in previous years was that the submission process for non-commercial products and the like was a little bit confusing. There wasn't a good layout for it on the NE site and whatnot.
Yeah, it was still confusing this year. It wasn't until like almost towards the end of the submission process people said, "Oh, podcast, you just have to fill out the form and send it to us."
Yeah, and that's kind of the thing. It was something you know that had been discussed last year. I didn't submit, of course, so I didn't know if it had changed or not, but it sounds like they might still be having a little bit of trouble with it.
I know I submitted the bone.
It was the same forces last year, yeah.
Yeah, I know that I submitted the Bone Scroll way back when, and it's like, when I originally read it, it was like, yeah, you have to send 6 copies. How the heck do you send 6 copies? So, you know, it wasn't until later they said, oh, blogs, you don't have to send 6 copies. You just have to send the form, too.
Yeah, okay. And they talked about maybe doing a cash, you know, if you don't send 6 copies, if you do it electronically, then you also have to do a submission fee. And, you know, there was a lot of discussion out there on what was actually going to go into it. So, you know, who knows? Maybe it'll be clearer next year.
Yeah, we'll let that sleeping dog lie till next year. And finally, what I think a lot of people are excited for is we got a sneak peek at the new Paizo Pathfinder Core Rulebook. Eric Mona actually has a YouTube video that actually kind of shows it to you. And we will have that in the show notes, a link to that. And honestly, that's a massive tome.
It is. It's like Hero System, try and stop a bullet with it, massive. It's it's impressive.
Is it Tolis grade?
Nothing's quite Tolis grade, but it's, you know, Paizo makes a very, very nice product. And, you know, in the video, you kind of get to see some of the production quality on there, and it's big. It's 576 page big, so, yeah.
Yeah, I can already tell you one thing I absolutely already like, and not that I could really see it in the video, but it looks like all the spell titles are in a black text box, so you know exactly where the spell names are in the page. None of this. It's there. Really? Where? You know, I think they have some pretty good definite block identifiers. So we'll see. I won't be. The funny thing is I'll be going to Gen Con, and my copy will be shipped to me because I pre-ordered. So. Well, does anybody else have anything else they'd like to give us news-wise? I think I covered most everything I could think of.
I just have one, if it's okay. I don't usually promo my own site, RPG Blog 2, but this week we have been doing Palladium Week over at my blog, and I have a really good interview. Well, I think it's a good interview with Kevin Cimbita, the owner of Palladium Books on there, and a couple other things. So if folks want to go by, I know we got a couple Palladium fans who listen, so definitely stop by. I'll get you a link for the show notes. So.
Excellent.
Alrighty, folks. That's all for the sideshow for now. Why don't we go and enter the Big Top and let's get the circus going. Ladies and gentlemen, if I can cast your attention to the center of the ring, you will see small press gaming companies.
All right, I'm batting leadoff this week. Okay. I was thinking of a good way to start this segment. We're going to talk about some small press gaming companies. And Phil, I don't know if they even play basketball up in Canada, do they? I mean, I think you guys have beat us a couple times. And
we actually invented this sport, but go ahead.
Oh, come on.
Look it up. Look it up.
Oh, I don't want to. My American pride can't stand it. I don't know if you guys follow March Madness at all, you know, the tourney, the college basketball and everything every March. But in college basketball, you know, you have your big powerhouse universities, and then you have what's called your mid-majors. And these are universities or colleges that don't have 50,000 students, 20,000 students, you know. But they're considered very, you know, every year a couple of them spring up and they hand it to the big guys, you know. Mm-hmm. And they get this reputation as they're smaller, but they can hang with the big dogs. And I think there's some gaming companies like that. And today I kind of wanted to talk about some of the small press gaming companies, kind of the pros and cons of that. You know, with the advent of the PDF and you know, selling that online and everything, we've seen a lot more small press companies coming out with niche titles that you may not have otherwise seen. You know, 10 years ago, one of my favorite companies is Flying Mice. And they do some very interesting, very niche titles that probably wouldn't have demanded a big print run, you know, 10, 15 years ago. But by selling in PDF and having that online networking, you know, they can make a go of it. You know, it's a different way to, I guess, do business. So I kind of wanted to go over a couple of the ones that I think really stand out as being smaller companies people may not have heard of, but they produce some interesting products, not always niche, sometimes, you know, standard fantasy. And I just kind of wanted to go over the list. And I see what you guys thought, if you'd heard of them, commentary and all that. So,
sure.
So you're going to tempt me into being unfaithful, right?
You know that gamer ADD is lurking it. Just below the surface.
By the way, in 1891, Dr. James Naismith, a Canadian physical education professor at McGill University in Montreal.
My alma mater.
Yeah.
Oh.
But he was in Springfield, Massachusetts when he invented it.
Well, clearly the inspiration didn't hit him until he crossed the border, right?
Exactly.
Fair enough. Okay.
Well, Massachusetts is basically Canada North. Canada South.
I thought that was Maine.
Well, Maine. I don't know what Maine is. Yeah, that's... Oh, boy. But anyway, one of the first companies I'm featuring is actually out of Massachusetts, and that is the aforementioned Flying Mice Games. And they're actually part of a little imprint group called Better Mousetrap Games. There's a couple different companies that sell products under that. But the best known imprint is Flying Mice. And Clash Bowley, he's kind of the guy who runs everything. And he's really big into military RPGs, Napoleonic era RPGs, and space and sci-fi. So he's done some really interesting settings. One of my favorites is In Harm's Way, which is kind of a troop-style game. If you guys have ever, you know, the movie Master and Commander, O'Brien's books, the Horatio Hornblower series. You know, you can play a French, British, or American, or, you know, I suppose you can expand it from there, privateer or midshipman during the Napoleonic War, the Revolutionary War, all these time frames around there, War of 1812, are open to you. And it's really an interesting game because it kind of has a troop play as well. So you might be playing this, you know, lieutenant who's out for glory, but you can also, you know, you can also play this. You can also play one, the bosun or the, you know, one of the sailors up in the rigging as the time comes. It's really an interesting, and I really don't have time to do it justice here. But it's one of those games that, you know, you think, oh well, someone's actually done that. You know, it's kind of neat that way. It's also got this kind of a cool mechanic where you know, you can end up getting this victory condition or making it out, but maybe you're crippled. You know, maybe you, you know, it's very much the reality of the day. You know, Lord, like Admiral Nelson, you know, with his one eye and a, you know, no arm, you know, just losing a limb here and there and everything. It's kind of the same thing. It's interesting. He's also got really a wealth of space games. And I don't know about you guys, but there's a lot of space games out there. You know, it seems like, and that's kind of a secondary genre sometimes, the fantasy.
Yeah. But well, I think I definitely would think that it is. It's second fiddle to fantasy.
Sure, yeah. But one of the nice things is it's also, like fantasy, very easy to pick up ideas from certain games and put them into other systems and games. And Clash just came out with a book called Commonwealth Space, which is part of his kind of, you know, in the future, you really have a humanity that's spread out, and there's been a lot of other conditions. You know, there's been generations of ships, you know, and so there's you know, he does settings where it's still very much the Cold War, where mankind's really spread out over the stars, but he's it's very much an interesting publisher. So I don't know if you guys have ever seen or heard any of his titles.
When you mentioned it, something clicked, and I went to see. And he also publishes RPG Pundit's game, right?
Yes, he also does publish the RPG Pundit's
game,
World War II Adventure, which is actually a pretty interesting system. It kind of does a melee system on both sides. And it is actually on the cover, it does say, written by RPG Pundit. So it's and it is spelled forward ... to adventure. So it's a very enthusiastic title. So definitely some things to check out over there. I would say don't let the formatting or layout distract you from what's inside, because Clash has kind of sometimes an elementary look to the games or a rougher look to the games, but what's inside is pretty much always gold. So,
Zach, why do I get the feeling when you talk about role-playing games that your hard drive at home is not filled with porn, but with PDFs of games?
Well, that is my porn, so. my wife doesn't like it any better, though, so. It's still a time waster, right? I have a lot of PDFs, and I will never, ever, ever get to play as many RPGs as I want, and it's just a depressing fact, so.
I hear you, man.
Yeah, jumping into another one here on a somewhat lighter note. Have you gentlemen ever heard of the game Squirrel Attack?
Squirrel Attack.
I have heard of it.
What's it with rodents today?
Oh, I have no idea. We go from flying mice to squirrels, right? This is a game by Hinterwelt Enterprises, and Hinterwelt is kind of interesting because they do some fairly serious settings. They do the RPG Roma Imperius, which was also a True 20 setting, which was very good. It was kind of, you know, the Roman Empire never fell. There's magic. It's a very, very great. It's probably one of my favorite settings. Just did a wonderful job. Bill Corey. It's actually the mastermind behind most of that, but Squirrel Attack is probably the one of the best titled games. There's a lot of titles for it, but it's just kind of a fun. I mean, you're playing squirrels. I mean, it's very light. It's very there's a lot of puns in it. There's a lot of whimsy, I guess. And, you know, I never thought my players would really go for it, but
so you're trying to say this kind of a beer and pretzel game that you pull out every once in a while?
I would say it's more beer and pretzels, but there's something, you know, you think like, oh boy, I would never do that. But, I mean, you look at it, and then you look at some of the supplements for it, like Squirrels Ahoy, Squirrels of the Spanish Main. you look at Shaolin Squirrels, Nuts of Fury.
Yay.
Operation Get Mr.
Get
Jones'
Mr. Jones's
Nuts.
Nuts.
Yes, there's Mr. Jones's Nuts. You know, there's just the pie incident. I mean, there are a number of titles that are just, you know, there's Nuts to the 70s. It's really it's a very, very not how do I want to put this? It's not full of itself funny. It's just out there to have a good time funny. You know, it doesn't. So it's they're fun little games. If you want something more serious, I would also recommend Roma Imperius, which is one of the best settings I've seen to date for the True 20 system. It's also written to be extremely easily divorceable. Actually, the way they write it is kind of the system in the front and the setting in the back, you know. So if that kind of alt history kind of fits with some fantasy mixed in has ever appealed to you, it's really something I'd recommend checking out. And just another small press company that's really garnered a very good reputation for what they do. So there's just a couple more. I know I don't want the segment to run on too long here. I know we got four rings to get through today. So there's also Dark Matter Studios, which did the Epic role-playing game. Kind of a rules medium skewed towards rules heavy, but just a very well put together game. Feels very polished. Has multiple magic systems that are just really, really engrossing and different from anything out there. The combat is very deadly. This damage tracking system is superb. They do kind of guilds and professions instead of basic classes, which makes it one of the easiest games I've ever seen to make a profession or guild for your character and still have it mean something without being too constraining. So that's Dark Matter Studios. Of course, one of my favorite named companies, Atomic Sock Monkey. you guys have probably heard of some of theirs. Their biggest one that just came out was Swashbucklers of the Seven Skies.
Yeah.
And they did that along with the guys from Evil Hat as well, Fred Hicks, and just tremendous. A swashbuckling skyship kind of campaign. Just really, they use a system called PDQ, which they also used in a product called Truth and Justice, which I always considered kind of the spiritual heir to the old Marvel Phaser Rip game. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys ever played that or not.
So the PDQ system is basically the columns with different ability levels, like remarkable,
well, no,
amazing.
But it kind of follows along that same kind of path. There's actually a free download you can do of the PDQ rules from the Atomic Sock Monkey site that kind of explain it better. But it is very much scaled sort of like that, you know, okay. With the 0+2, it's It has very much the same kind of feel. I've heard several people, and I also refer to it as kind of a spiritual heir of that game. That's Truth and Justice. It's one of the games that kind of get that not all superhero companies are going to be, you know, uniform in power. You know, some people are going to – very scalable. So, but yeah, two very good games, and, you know, both have gotten rave reviews from multiple areas of the internet. And one of the most prolific publishers, to wrap it up, is Precise Intermedia, formerly Politically Incorrect Games. And they're known for their Disposable Heroes line, which is a customizable, you know, print-your-own-minis line.
Okay, that sounds familiar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's probably what they're best known for, I would say. But they have – it really – there's not even time to really go through all of them here, but – Precise Intermedia is known for having very reasonable, sensible systems that are very modular and easy to pick up. And they've covered just about any genre I can think of, from space to Wild West to your base fantasy to post-apocalyptic. They also have a fantastic space war game called Warcosm, which is just dirt cheap. They also did probably what I think is, well, it's the best pulp game I've played in a decade, which was Two-Fisted Tales. Very good. So, and other games. Yeah. Two-Fisted Tales is just tremendous. It uses gimmicks to kind of round your character. It really seems to get what I think most people think of. I'm not a pulp purist by any means. But I really think that it gets what most people think of when they think of the pulp fiction of the 30s and those old radio shows and everything. it's not hard to see incorporating the Shadow into it, or Buck Rogers, or any of those things. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think so. So, bottom line, there'll be a lot in the show notes, but you know, there's a lot of games out there that it just seems like are just kind of sitting there, and it's like, hey, these are great games, you know, and they're small press, they don't have a good advertising budget, but it's worth doing your homework and digging around a little bit sometimes. So,
here's a subject suggestion for a later show: is how to get your friends to accept to play a game of those games with you.
That's yes, true. And that's their big drawback. You know, I think one of the biggest things they have going for them is an enthusiastic publisher who is also a gamer in all likelihood, and you get that very much more that personal interaction from the company. Some bigger companies do that well, some don't, but mm-hmm. with a smaller press company, it's like, hey, this guy's a gamer, making stuff for gamers. On the other hand, you don't have the gaming network that you might have with a Watsy or a Paizo or even a Steve Jackson, you know, so,
yeah,
you know trade-off.
Honestly, a lot of the smaller games are mostly played by people who have been gaming a long time, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And some groups, you know, usually there's an alpha gamer in a group who can bring something back and say, hey, let's try this.
Let's try this.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's one way, but I think Phil's right. It's probably better expanded on in a later show, or expounded on, rather.
Well, hopefully somebody's writing notes. That's not me.
Scribble.
All righty. Well, I think we should go ahead and get on to the next ring. Ladies and gentlemen, if you can feast your eyes in the heavens to the high wire, we look at game balance. Well, interesting thing, if you ask somebody about game balance, I'm pretty sure you're going to hear a lot of opinions about exactly what that means. I honestly can't really tell you what that means. And people say, oh, well, the game... Well, no, I mean, people say, well, the game isn't balanced right. You know, and it's like, well, I know what I think game balance is, but it's not what you're talking about there. I actually bothered to look up in Wikipedia. There's actually an entry, it'll be in the show notes, that says game balance. They actually have kind of two descriptions. The first one is, a game can be called unbalanced if one or more players have an unfair advantage over the others. Okay, pretty simplistic, but that actually explains almost like one mindset for what game balance is. Mm-hmm. The other one is, and this is from Wikipedia, a more complex definition of game balance that critics have described is that when players have multiple options or routes to victory, most or all these options are about equally effective or feasible. And, I guess my question to everybody is, how is that really possible? You know, so basically you have two options. You have balanced players and balanced adventures is kind of what, when people talk game balance, that's really one of the two things that they're trying to talk about, it seems. And I don't know, it just, I'm sure people love 4th edition, but that's one of the things, I mean, that's what people cite about 4th edition. The game balance is, you know, it has good game balance. And I don't know, I've looked at it. Game doesn't really interest me, so I haven't gone into the game balance arena. But one of the blogs, a guy actually described what he finally thought was the problem with 4th edition to him, was that they've gone to player balance so bad that you can actually just, you know, there at different levels, no player has certain advantages that other players don't have, which was something that was very common in the old system. You know, you would have a rogue, and during, you know, especially, you know, AD&D when it first started, it's like, you know, the wizard sucked at first level, so they'd kind of have to run and hide, where, you know, by eighth level, you know, they would take out things that the fighters would be afraid to face, you know, and it's just, and I want, you know, and it's like one of those things where I think there is a balance overall in those type of scenarios. And it's also, is it really fun if everyone is equal? You know,
you're referencing the Pixar movie, The Incredibles, when everybody's special, no one is.
Yes.
Actually, what I'd like to reference is, I think it was a, one of the new Twilight Zone episodes that actually had Sean Austin, of all people. Future world where, you know, anyone above intelligence wore this headset that made them, that dropped their intelligence, you know. People
well,
who
that's
played...
a Kurt Vonnegut, that's a Kurt Vonnegut short story.
Oh,
or
is
something
it?
Like that.
Yeah. Well, I'm, you know, and it's like, you know, oh, you know, there's the guy with the baseball bat. He's really good at baseball. So we're going to put weights on his bat so he's not as good as ever. So everyone is exactly equal. And, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and that's kind of what it reminds me of. But go ahead.
I play for E exclusively, and I've been playing. I've been DMing it for about a year.
Yeah, so, and, I mean, what are your thoughts on that, really?
The thing that I found out the most is that D&D 4E does not cater for every gaming needs. That's a given. And one type of player, and a lot of players that decried the new focus on balance were those types of players. What 4E does not support anymore is the lone wolf type of player. That player that would choose a wizard, take his lumps for the first six levels, knowing that he would be the equivalent of a demigod, kill everything, and make a lot of other characters irrelevant later in the campaign because he could kill everything with fireballs or high-level spells. And up till D&D 3.5, you add classes like that, or you could build classes like that where you could shine by being good alone. Now, that's not possible anymore because while I agree all classes are balanced, all classes are able to do things in the same power level, they're not. One class alone cannot do everything. So the game has shifted. Yes, there is balance. Yes, they're all more or less equivalent in power. So there's not a lot of exploits, but you need a full group of about three, four, or at least five players to have a complete experience. And in that particular concept, you've got a team balance that's there. Basically, it's a team game. It's there's no other way to.
Well, that's very interesting because it's like, you know, one of the things that I mean, just in my mind. I mean, that's interesting that you say that they need 3 to 5 players because it's like I know I've actually played a lot of sessions where I had like two. So
and it's a lot harder to play.
Yeah.
It is. And I like with the older editions how easy it is to play. Just you can have a one-on-one game.
Yeah.
The only class that I've found that can really hold its own in 4th edition is probably the Bard. And that's simply for their ability to heal themselves a lot.
Yeah. Well, the thing is like most game systems, is that if you take a published adventure and take just a small party, there's no way it's going to work. You need to basically tailor your adventure to the party you're playing with. Like, I play with my 7-year-old son, and I control 3 NPCs, and he has his own character. And I tailor encounters so that they're a lot easier, because I don't want my 7-year-old son to deal with all the resource management that this game can have. I mean, the designers play with spreadsheets. So,
yeah, that's a scary thought.
You know, to get away from 4E and previous D&D editions in a while, I think that one of the things I see when people discuss this issue, and it's discussed a lot online for multiple systems, but is that when people talk about game balance, it doesn't mean perhaps what some GMs would have. How do I put it? It seems like when they're talking about game balance, they're talking about system balance. I think game balance is something that comes about as a function of the GM, having an impartial GM. I mean, I play Rifts, for heaven's sakes. I mean, you know, you can have a vagabond with his pistol and his little bit of candy, which is in the Rifts book, is one of the things he gets. you know, and there's a glitter boy, you know, which is the big boom gun, you know, juggernaut next to him, and then you've got a, you know, you've got a rogue scholar who's trying to find books next to a, you know, malicious killing machine of a juicer hopped up on so many drugs and, you know, superhumanly fast. And, you know, is the system itself balanced in that case? Oh, no. No, 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 no. But as a GM, I know that there's a niche for everyone in there. And if I can find that niche and I concentrate on their face time, it's almost like doing an ensemble cast for something, you know. You know, it's almost like like an ensemble TV show. You know, everyone's got their favorites, and you know this person's going to come in here, this person's there. And it's like that in the game, too. You know, is this giant cyborg going to be able to find repair parts here? Is the little street urchin going to be able to avoid police detection where he wouldn't, you know? And I think in a lot of places, people have substituted system balance for game balance. System balance can make game balance easy, but you can still have an unbalanced game with the most perfectly balanced, everyone is the same special snowflake yep. kind of system. And I don't know if it's an abandonment of GM responsibility, or I think that's too harsh, but certainly it's a substitution of meaning.
I'm going to say that I think a lot of – I'm going to get hate mail for this. But I think, I think a lot of modern systems kind of – and I mean this is not just D&D 4th edition. This is a lot of games – have kind of taken the stance that the DM isn't very important.
No, mm-hmm. I disagree. Go ahead.
Well, no, I mean that's not to say – the DM is important, but it's weird. It's like, well, I just get the feeling that, you know, we have this wish to take, in some aspects, we want to take the DM out of the equation, and we don't want to rely on him for, you know, even rule interpretations even.
The way I noticed it was there are two issues in that. The first thing is that the era of the tyrant DM is gone.
Well, yeah,
it's not going to come back. Even though Tracy Ickman is coming out with something that seems to be pushing forwards, and RPG Pundit is kind of pushing forwards that the period of the tyrant is gone. But also, especially with the with book from the moment GURPS came out, and especially D&D 3 edition, third edition, the onus, the pressure of all the rules were taken from behind the screen. In first edition of the AD&D, all the rules were in the hands of the DM, and players mm-hmm. knew how to make characters, and I had an idea of how to roll characters, but the combat rules were in the Dungeon Master Guide, right? And all of these, all the crunch was transferred into the player's handbook, was transferred into the player's hand. So now, while the DM gets to say yes or no and make calls when there are issues with the rules, players have the responsibility of learning the rules and using them. Now, from that point forward, when they went from 3rd edition to 4th edition, they needed to balance the rules because now they were in the hands of the players. And you've got people, as much as you've got abusive DMs, you've got abusive players.
I would think that's more apt than abusive, because there's more, I mean, let's face it, there's more players than DMs.
Totally.
Yeah. Well, which is where, you know, like, speaking of game balance, I mean, that's why, you know, different systems try to attack it at different ways. It's like,
yeah.
One of my favorite systems I don't get to play is the Hero system. And honestly, it's probably too complicated. But, you know, they try to balance things in, well, much the same way that GURPS eventually tried to balance things, with point costs. You know, point buys for this, point buys for that. And it's like, okay. You know, and it works, but that gives rise to, like you said, you know, players doing the infamous, oh, this is the optimal position. Let me, use my, you know, calculus to figure out the optimal point cost that I need to spend. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that happens. And so I don't know. I mean, I think we're going to be having this game balance discussion for a long time. I think no matter, you know, role-playing games or not, I think it's an issue with almost any game you play. People, we're going to be having this discussion until all of us are probably dead in the grave.
Well, if you look at the Burning Wheel role-playing game, mm-hmm. they sort of just yeah. throw game balance out the window, because if you try to play a human next to one of the elves, the human is completely ineffective, because naturally elves are so much better, because it's following it more of the story type, where it really comes down to, yeah, the elf could be a lot better as far as their stats go, but it's a matter of role-playing.
Yeah.
And even the weakest human could be far better than the best elf.
You know, it's all based on role-playing. I was going to say, one of the things that bothers me about the entire attempt of some games to move from the centralization, or at least the consolidation of power in the DM or GM's hands to more of the players, I don't have a problem with it per se, except that in every group I've been in, there's a lot of players who don't want that level of responsibility. You know, it comes in that And different games handle it. I mean, some give the players a little bit, and they can handle that. Some games give the players a lot, and everyone is a shared, you know, it's almost like you have four DMs at the table. And there's players who want to show up, quietly roll their dice, you know, or, you know, however, they're not that interactive. And some people, well, I don't really want to play with people like that. Well, that's fine, you know, but I've always had a couple quiet guys who I still liked having in the game. You know, I know that I couldn't count on them for, you know, a 15-page backstory, or, you know, it might take them a while to pick up the rules, but they were still my friends. We were still hanging out, and, you know, they'd have their time in the sun. So I've always looked at the DM as you're going to have one to two guys in your group, most groups, that are kind of the lead, you know, or kind of willing to take that burden. Or, you know, the work that goes into it. So, we can talk about the era of the adversarial GM, and it certainly seems like with 4E that's gone away a little, although I'm sure there's plenty of 4th edition players with dead characters who would, you know, but that's a DM by DM basis, you know.
But there's, I mean, a lot there's of vassals games in humanity, yeah.
I think that's putting me kindly.
Yeah, but I still think there are games, although not as large. You know, Mongoose Traveler still has a very, very classic, I guess, DM player or referee player representation. Pathfinder, I mean, we'll see. Is Rule Zero still in there? We'll see. I think the jury's still out on that one. But, you know, with the old school Renaissance, certainly a more classic or traditional representation. So, it may have waned, but who knows? You know, who knows what the future will bring?
Yeah, well, so, you know, eventually robots will just come and wipe us all out, and will they be playing role-playing games?
We'll see. Yeah. Well, we won't, but someone will.
So
it's going to be called Humans and Normons.
Well, you know, the old. I still my favorite cartoon from the old DMG is we're playing Papers and Paychecks.
Papers and Paychecks, yeah.
So, oh yeah.
Alrighty, so why don't we move on? If the audience can adjust their eyes back down to Earth, we will be finding role-playing game adventures in everything we do.
Alright, so I was at Ice Age 3 the other day. Me and my wife took my son to go see that. And all I could think the entire time I was watching it was, this would make a really awesome adventure.
You're just calling in the geek trope. Go ahead.
Yeah, because I've noticed lately that any movie I watch, any book I read, anything I do, I always find myself thinking, I could totally run a game like this.
Preaching to the choir, brother. Oh, yeah.
Have you ever pulled it off?
I have, actually.
Oh, really?
This must have been a couple months ago. I actually ended up taking one of the monsters, one of the big, huge monsters from Shadow of the Colossus. In fact, it was the first monster you face. And I actually ended up running my players up against it. Because when I was playing the game, I thought it would be awesome to see a whole group of adventurers have to go up against this thing. And so I ended up actually writing up the rules for it and ended up running it, and if anybody's played Shadow of the Colossus, basically the creatures can only be killed through very specific means. And so they were playing 4th edition, and the monster didn't have any hit points. I mixed a skill challenge with combat together to make it so that they had this really complicated way that they had to figure out how to kill it, and then they had to go about killing it.
Very cool. Very nice.
So, what other things have you guys found that?
It's an interesting thing. I've often noticed, Mark, that we often come to the same ideas, but by parallel means. Because I don't think that we spend a lot of time on each other's blogs, and because I actually wrote that I think 18 months ago a post about climbing huge monsters and killing them, and I basically took an image from Shadow of the Colossus. But to answer your question, one of the things that I've noticed about when you come out of a movie and says, "Oh, this would make such a great game," we often find ourselves either the idea goes away before we move on it, or we're stuck trying to create an adventure, and we don't want to recreate the same movie because your friends have seen the movie.
Well, not only that, that's the classic death knell. We're gonna do this adventure. It's like, don't I know this? I don't want to do that. No. It has to go this way. That kind of thing.
Yeah, you're totally right. One of the tricks I found is that you can steal a few tropes from the movie. The key ones, the tropes or the cliches that gave the movie the feel, that gave that story the part that you really like. So is it because the bad guy was a magnificent bastard? Is it this huge mecha monster in a fantasy world? And you just basically grab those elements, but then you weave those in a completely different story.
Absolutely. There's a reason those movies and those books of our childhood and our teenage years and everything call to us so much, because they have these tremendous elements. And I mean, you know, whether it's doing that final run on the Death Star or something, I mean, it's the feel of that, I think, that really, I mean, we're like, wow, you know, that's what we capture.
Yeah. And you know, you've hit. What you wanted to have when your character and your players give you feedback is, I felt like I was in a book by that guy, or I felt like I was in a movie by that guy, and that's basically what you're aiming at.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of my big ones is history. I read about something, you know, I'm a huge history buff, and I read something about history, and, you know, I find a way, you know, history is somewhat of a more obscure topic for a lot of people, but it's very easy. Like, I read about the Duke of Wellington and his mannerisms and stuff, and I needed a kind of a crusty, very stuffy general for one of my campaigns for a fantasy world. I actually used Wellington's picture. I found one. I found one that didn't look too,
complain.
Yeah, he didn't care. You know, but that friggin' big old hook nose of his and everything, and I'm like, okay, here's this guy, and you know, I did what I could of his mannerisms from what I read of him and everything. You know, it was a bit of a caricature, but you know, you read about these things, or I'll read about a Civil War battle or something and be like, huh, what if the battle, you know, if there's a fantasy battle, what if it kind of goes like this a little bit? You know, what if it's a little bit like, you know, the players have an opportunity if they find it of rolling up the flank here like Lee did at Chancellorsville or, you know, wherever. So, you know, I think history is a big one as well.
Yeah, I think history is definitely a underutilized setting.
Yeah. And when you're studying history, it's definitely part of something you're in every day and everything, and to port that over, I think, kind of fits the topic as well.
Yeah.
And Mark, another aspect of that that's very interesting is if you're lucky enough, or unlucky, depending on how you see it, to have a specialist player in your group. Do you guys know what a specialist is? You know that one, that guy or girl that always plays the same type of character class?
Yeah.
They want to play a ninja or those players are often the guys that will tell you after a movie, this made such a great game. So you can harness those particular players to basically, you create an adventure and you make sure that the specialist's character fits in that particular adventure taken from the movie, and you'll have an ally that will basically pull the adventure and the party in it full blown.
Unless, of course, they're the ones that play the money grubbing dwarves, no matter what genre you're playing.
Yeah. just slightly off topic, I have a player who has now played a cleric in, or a healer type in our last 8 campaigns consecutively.
Wow.
Either a medic or a cleric. And it always comes down to, hey, what are you playing? Oh, I don't know. Do we have a cleric? No. Oh, I'll be the cleric.
Yes.
is he the type to heal players, or he doesn't heal anyone?
Oh, no, he's a healer. Oh, I mean, he's a fantastic healer. He's just very comfortable in that role, and, you know.
He's found his own.
The first couple times, I'm like, don't you want to, you know, spread your little wings and fly and do something else? I'm like, no, and I'm okay. I'm cool with it. The group's cool with it. Why mess with him? So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, here's one other thing that I is a piece of advice that I took once, and I have to say it's true. Especially is people that you know from your past, you can always use, you know, because they have their certain mannerisms. It's like, you know these people. Your players may have never met them. You can use them, caricatures of them, as NPC prototypes.
That's true. I have done that.
You know, and that's a classic piece of bit I don't even remember where either I read that or it was suggested, but it's absolutely true. I use people that I knew in the Navy.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder how many demonic witch queens in games out there are ex-girlfriends or mother-in-laws, you know?
Or how many gruff instructors are your old military instructors.
You know? Oh, I know a couple of mine were based on that. Every time I get a crusty sergeant, a drill sergeant, my drill instructor or something, or my training instructor.
Yeah, exactly. So, all righty. Well, I mean, is there anything else we've seen in daily life?
No, I just wanted to point out those few things. One thing I just realized with Ice Age 3 was just if you go and watch the movie, you'll realize just how perfectly it would fit in as an RPG adventure, because they basically have to descend into the Underdark and happen to stumble upon this underground jungle place, and they're trying to save somebody. And you can keep that as generic as you want and basically play the exact same thing, but there's a ton of dinosaurs, and I think dinosaurs are one of the underutilized aspects of D&D in a lot of ways. And I would love to run a game just full of dinosaurs and running around in a giant jungle. So,
heck yeah.
I'm currently writing a D&D adventure for kids, and as research material, I'm looking at all the Miyazaki anime movies, but a lot of adventure movies for kids like Goonies or Stand By Me, and they're all perfect materials.
Yeah.
RPGs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of writing, RPG Circus is proud to present by special engagement, landing your first role-playing game writing gig.
All right. As some of you know, I started blogging about 2 years ago, just so I would leave my friends alone, and their inbox alone about those five pager things that I thought about for our game. So I basically transferred that to blogging, and as you also know, I've recently landed a few freelance RPG writing gigs.
No, say it isn't so.
Yeah, it is. It is. Well, actually, I have a book coming out in August. And
well, you can put a plug in here for whatever that is. I don't remember off the top of my head.
Next month, my first D&D 4E adventure will come out in an anthology by Goodman Games called From Here to There. And it's an anthology of 9 D&D adventures that focus on what happens while PCs go from point A to point B. So it's not necessarily where the quest that they're going to is. That's not what we're covering. It's something happens while going there, and my adventure is a Lovecraftian themed adventure. Basically, while they're walking to a certain point, they stumble onto something very weird and dangerous.
Very cool.
So, one of the things I wanted to give is that I see on the RPG Bloggers Network and in readers that send comments on the blog is that a lot of people would like to become writers, either full-time or part-time freelance for the RPG industry, and nobody's really sure how to do it. And I think there's a new formula that's been developed in very recent years that might be worth discussing, and you'll tell me what you think. I personally believe that the best way to get your first writing gig as an RPG writer is to start a blog. And I'll toot my own horn. But with the recent explosion of RPG blogs, and I've seen that a lot of people with talent have moved away from forums that are too impersonal. I mean, there are too many forums, too many posts to get noticed. And so when you start your own blog, you basically give your own taste, your own flavor, and you basically – there's only one writer or two if you've got a team blog that writes on that particular website, and that allows you to practice – get better at writing, get feedback from readers, usually your friends when you start, but once you start getting readers, you get better and better. And once you've established yourself for, I would say, like half a year or a year, you can basically use your website as a portfolio or as a resume to land your gigs. And that's what happened to me.
Yeah. You know, the other thing too is I'm also, this is kind of an observation of my own, I've noticed that a lot of people who have been doing blogging have had serious, are doing it or have had made serious considerations of starting their own publishing companies that do what they want to do.
Yeah. Yes, totally. It's one of the path, because once you start writing lots of good RPG material and you want to learn more about the industry, doing it, becoming a self-publisher is a good approach. I decided to go the other way, for starters, to write as a freelance, so I could learn from the different people in the hobby. So I actually landed my first gig by meeting a writer at Gen Con. His name is Arlie Sro. He works for Goodman Games. And it's kind of funny, because I bought one of his modules and I've asked him to sign it. And he was so shocked. I think I was the first con-goer to ever ask him to sign an adventure. And I basically sent him an email later on telling him that I was going to blog about his adventure. And I wrote game reports about it. And he gave me lots of feedback, and we've exchanged. I asked him questions about that. And at a certain point, I sent him a pitch for something, an idea I had. And it didn't work. He said they weren't interested about that. We said, hey, if you ever have another idea, call me back. And a few weeks afterwards, he asked me if I wanted to submit an adventure from here to there. And that's basically how it started.
Very cool.
So it's because the advantage of a blog is you can start having discussions and conversations with people that leave comments on your website. And often those people work for the industry.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I found it's a nice way for just the feedback alone.
Yeah,
you know, it's just tremendous. I've reconsidered a couple things on how I personally present things. You know, just based on, you know, a comment person probably didn't think anything of it, but I'm like, huh. Well, let me look at that. You know, so.
Well, if someone makes the effort of leaving a comment on the blog, because I think you've got between 10, like 1 and 10% of people of your readers will leave comments, and that's it.
That's it. Yeah.
I remember getting super psyched when Jamie Chambers from Margaret Weiss Productions ended up commenting.
That's fun, huh?
I
had a few geek outs myself when some people I really admired left comments on my website then.
Yeah,
it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, my personal favorite for mine is I made a comment about some old Dragon Magazine article which talked about nonviolent magic items, and it was like, wow. And the guy who actually wrote the article commented, and I'm like, wow, I didn't even know he was still alive.
You know. That's one of the things. I think it's Robin Laws who told me that they authors often make vanity searches on Google, and they'll spot articles, blog articles, where people talk about what they do. So they often see what you write about them or write about stuff that they've written. So that's how you get your comments and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. It's very cool. So, but any other advice to the budding professionals besides, you know, blogging and...
Well, once you start being more comfortable with writing materials for RPG, and once you've given yourself, you should give yourself one true RPG project that you might not want to publish, but start, design it, write it. It can be an adventure, it can be a setting book, but see it through so that you can prove that your nerd projectitis is proof. And once you've done that, you submit. If you haven't made contacts with the industry yet, if you don't have friends who know people that can help you submit to whatever company that you want to submit for, the ones I've got a few examples. I've got for the entry level ones, Chris Tregenza's who has the 6D6 Fireball blog has an adventure contest. That you basically pitch him an idea, and since he gives you feedback about how the idea could be tweaked to be better, asks you to write an adventure, and he publishes it for you as a free PDF, or he helps you publish it for you.
Actually, you know, the one I can think of is, you know, Pathfinder's
Star Project.
What was it?
Well,
there's that, and I was also thinking of their other one that they have. They have the Pathfinder Society open calls that they do all the time.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm writing adventures for them, so that's a good idea to go. Wolfgang Bauer is always interested in pieces for Kobold Quarterly, so you send him queries, and he even says in his submission guidelines that if you want to do something steampunkish, he's going to look at it. and he's going to be interested about it. So, right, and I was told by one of his collaborators that there's not a lot of competition for 4E right now because most of the people are writing for 3.5 and Pathfinder.
Interesting.
You know how I actually, the first thing I ever got published was through the Rifter for Palladium, which is an in-house, which is an in-house instrument. A couple companies have something, you know, similar to that, maybe just as a PDF or something, but that's another way. You know, I just wrote up a little article on a Western prospecting town after I'd watched a Deadwood marathon, and, you know, I put it out there, and sure enough, you know, it got in. I was like, oh, wow. You know, I can't believe it actually got in a publication, you know, but so a couple different ones to go through.
And just so people know the going rates, I mean, if you write for Goodman Games, Kobold Quarterly, or Dungeons or Dragon magazines, they're all paid gigs, but they're mostly between 3 and 6 cents a word. So a lot of people are thinking about making their life living off this, not when you start. I still have a full-time day job. But if you start once you've established your own credibility and you've got a few products done by a few companies, then you might start your own imprint, and people who are fans of yours will probably follow you.
Very good.
All righty. Well, I think that kind of wraps up the rings for now. However, you know, we do have some audio comments from our last couple of episodes, which I'm very happy to say that we received. And let's go ahead and play those now. Let me go ahead and cue up the first one that we have here. There we go. First one is by Daryl Simmons, and let's see what he has to say for us.
Hello, my name is Daryl Simmons. Listened to episode 1 and 2 of your podcast. Thought it was excellent. During your second podcast, I believe it was, you asked for comments or criticism or whatever. Basically, the only criticizing I have, but it's going to be rectified soon, is, you know, content. You know, you kind of struggle a little bit of finding what to talk about. But, you know, as more and more people start listening and calling in and sending stuff, that'll be a thing of the past. Great podcast. Nice to see a podcast that doesn't talk about video games, you know, talk about the stuff where video games actually come from, you know, ideas and being imaginative and stuff. So, really appreciate it. So, keep up the good work. All right. Bye-bye.
Well, Daryl.
Hey, guys, Walker.
Whoa! Wrong one. It went right into the second one. Yeah, I didn't hit stop. Well, that's just the way this thing is set. It's kind of weird. Well, Daryl, I'm glad you have enjoyed the podcast. I'm kind of curious to know what podcast you've been listening to that talks about video games. That's supposed to be a role playing game one, but hopefully this episode is much improved in based off of your comments. We try to take these things to heart. Hopefully this has been an improvement for you. So, anyone have any comments for him in addition to that, or should we just go on to the next one? See what Walker P. had to say.
Oh, thanks for the thanks for comment.
Yeah, thanks for the feedback.
The next one is Walker P.
Yeah.
He hosts the RPG Aven podcast.
Oh. Yes, he does. Yeah, oh,
yeah.
Good guy.
Yeah, so he's a Montreal friend of mine. Yeah.
Oh, excellent. Let's see what your friend has to say to us.
Hey guys, Walker P here from the RPG Haven podcast. And just want to say I really enjoy your show. It's getting off to a great start. I wanted to comment about your little discussion about Savage World. At one point, when it was mentioned that if you get the Joker, you can go at any point during the round, two of you said, "Well, wouldn't you just want to go at the beginning?" And that was sort of just left hanging there as a given. In my experience, Savage World, the combat tends to be so dynamic that it's very rare that when a Joker does come up that a player just takes the first move. First of all, one thing you didn't mention is that when you have a Joker, you can interrupt any other character's action. So you can actually wait until the big baddie is going to do something and you can try and stop it right there. Another thing is that there's a state called Shaken where you get sort of temporarily stunned for the round. And at the end of a round, when characters are shaken, during the next round, they try to get unshaken. If you have several bad guys, you can wait and see which ones become unshaken before you attack them. Those are just a couple of examples, but I find with the way the initiative system works in Savage Worlds really creates very, very dynamic combat where a lot of different things are going on, and when you get the Joker, it's quite exciting to sit and wait and watch what each player, each character does on the ground and finally decide to make your move. Thank you very much. Great show. Keep up the good work.
Well,
excellent.
Yeah, I think that was actually a good comment. Actually, I played my first game of Savage Worlds this last weekend. Unfortunately, my bookbinding had an epic fail.
Mine's done that.
Yeah, I contacted them. They want me to ship it back, and they're going to send me a new book. So that's not a big problem. Apparently, I guess they had some problem with the print run. But yeah, he's absolutely right with that. Not that we experienced that in my game session, but he's right. They get to move anywhere, and there will be cases where that stuff comes up, and you know, having actually only played now combat once, I can't say, but you know, that's one of those things, experience like that. So far my players have sort of liked the Savage World rules. So we're gonna do one more, because it was actually supposed to be a one shot. We're gonna do one more one shot.
Excellent.
Nice.
Yeah. So.
Half my gaming circle's actually putting in for the Explorer edition.
Oh.
So, yeah, they were, a buddy of mine just started a new Deadlands campaign with Savage Worlds, and they are just loving it, so, yeah.
I'll play the role of the reader who hasn't never tried it. Could you, in less than a minute, sell me on Savage Worlds?
$10.
Well,
it costs. Done.
Sold. That was our first snafu.
Yeah. Yes, I'm going to try to hopefully edit that out of the thing.
So do we want to go back to Phil asking about...
yes, Phil asked...
That's actually really good. Yeah.
Phil asked a good question.
Just say when.
Yeah, right now. I mean, we're just...
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just going to edit this in, so...
All right. So my question is, for a gamer who's never played Savage World, who's seen it in convention plays and heard about it, what would be the one-minute elevator speech to accept the $10 book to sell me on it?
It's got quick, fast character creation that's also very dynamic. It's also got some really great combat. The combat moves very fast, a lot faster than you'd see in any edition of D&D. What about you guys? Do you guys got anything?
I think it is a very easy learning curve.
Yeah,
I know that stuff you can say a lot about a lot of systems, but $10, you know, it's...
I think I would go for $10. I'm going to use the company line: fast, furious, fun, and highly adaptable. I think that pretty much is my elevator speech for $10. I mean, it's like, you can't go...
Is it? But I mean, the $10 is just the Explorer edition. There's like a box edition. Okay.
Well, actually...
Well, the Explorer edition has everything in it. It's just it's much smaller
digest size.
Yeah.
It's not like a half, you know, like a half-assed quick start or anything. I mean, it's a full RPG. Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
It's
the only two books I own are that and the Necessary Evil, which is a campaign setting.
Yeah, I'd actually like to pick that up.
So at Gen Con, I'm going to pick that up, and I'm going to pick Mouse Guard up. Right, fair enough.
Yes.
Yeah. Hey, Phil, I have Mouse Guard on my list, too.
Yeah, actually, I think I do, too, just because it sounds like, okay, this sounds interesting.
So, my brother just got it, and he says that he likes it a lot.
I'm a Burning Wheel fan, so.
Yeah, but it seems to be a good introductory game to Burning Wheel, or Burning Engine.
And possibly a family game as well. You know, my daughter's getting up where I'm starting, you know, to we kind of like you and your son, Phil, we tell stories every night and everything. And, you know, I've been looking at the comic. I think she'd really like it. You know, half the time she likes Swords and Dragons, half the time, you know, she likes superheroes, and half the time she likes Disney princesses. I know that's three halves, but three halves.
Actually, our daughters would be best friends forever. She's the same, except she speaks French.
Mine does not. She speaks Spanish. That's it.
Okay. Do we have any additional comments? I grabbed the audio comments. Did we have any other ones that we wanted to give this time?
My dad actually.
Oh, that's right.
He's actually been listening to the podcast. and
God bless him.
He actually has really good. Yeah, he's a old school gamer. He hasn't gamed in years and years.
So you were raised by a gamer?
Yes, but he was never a gamer. Like, apparently, he stopped gaming around the time my older brother was born, and hadn't gotten back into it. So I'm hoping actually this Christmas to go back home and maybe run a game for him to let him see how things have changed since first edition. Actually, he said he owned the original D&D books, and he was getting out of it and ended up selling them. He says probably for about $10 for all the books. And he says he's kicking himself now because they're worth hundreds.
I'm still waiting for my son to discover the huge banker's buck of Card Wars I've got here. So.
Oh, yeah. but this was his comment. He says, I really enjoyed listening to RPG Circus. I would echo some of the comments that have been left on your site, though. Once you guys get into the main things you're talking about, it gets very good. The start is slow, though. And you are all kind of nervous getting acquainted once again. Like I said, I really like it, but it is slow getting started, and some people might not stick around until the good parts. The show is witty. Each guy is obviously very intelligent and well-informed. For example, right off the cuff. What's up?
I was about to say, I don't know if I'm that well-informed.
Did we pay him? Is that in the budget?
he says, for example, right off the cuff, referring to what would happen if Rommel wasn't stopped in a particular place or on the third day of Gettysburg, or allusions to other games or story references. Obviously, everyone really knows their stuff. Good job.
Well,
great. Awesome. Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. Very cool he listened.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's very cool that we didn't have to pay him to say those things.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, well, thank you. I think that about wraps it up for our comments. For those of you out there listening, if you ever want to leave us comments, we'd love to have them. You can do it one of two ways. You can either email us at info@rpgcircus.com or leave us a voicemail message like our other friends have at 1-888-643-6322. That was 1-888-643-6322. I have a problem saying that twice, by the way. we look forward to seeing comments from you. I think that just about wraps it up. But before we strike the tents, does anyone have any closing comments?
Well, it was very fun. I hope you'll invite me again.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Anytime, Phil. It was great. I also want to say to everyone who left a comment on Twitter for our Twitter RPG Circus account, we will get to you. So,
yeah.
So,
yeah. Oh, definitely, people. That's a good point. We do have a Twitter account, RPG Circus, and we do actually also have a Facebook page for RPG Circus. You can do a search and find it. So we hope you come again, and we will see you next time.